This is Talking History. Talking History is a weekly radio program focusing on history. It examines our past and how we recall it, how we preserve it, how we interpret it, and how we transform it into myth. Talking History is a co-production of the University at Albany History Department, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska.
One more day.
Get him.
Hey, Gary. Carville. What, give me. And we can't lose North Carolina. Who's going to carry Georgia? We don't care. You think so? Don't worry about Georgia. Really? God damn, if we don't carry Georgia, we're going to look terrible. I say if we lose Georgia, we win. We lose the race.
I need your help. The governor's voice is completely gone, and he will not be able to speak.
We fought for a year. We got 2 days to go. My voice will be better by this afternoon, and I'll be there Monday. I'll be there Tuesday. Fight on. Don't give up. Go.
Stay focused. Talk about things that matter to people. You know? It's the economy, stupid. Okay?
And vote for Mr. Rizzo, the people's choice. You'll be happy with them. Take my advice and vote for Mr. Rizzo. I'm voting twice.
Welcome to Talking History. This is Julian Zelizer, Assistant Professor of History and Public Policy at the State University of New York at Albany. A week ago, I was privileged to speak with two of the nation's leading documentary filmmakers, D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hegedus. Their work has included landmark films such as The Energy War, Town Bloody Hall, and The War Room, a movie that was nominated for an Academy Award and received the D.W. Griffith Award for Best Documentary from the National Board of Review. Most recently, they have released the film Moon Over Broadway, which focuses on the production of a Broadway play, Moon Over Buffalo, that starred Carol Burnett. Mr. Pennybaker also directed the classic documentary Don't Look Back, which focused on the musician Bob Dylan just as he was breaking onto the national music scene. Together, Pennybaker and Hegedus have revolutionized the art of documentary filmmaking. They've helped introduce and develop cinema verite, also called direct cinema, in which they've removed themselves from the film. They've pioneered a style of documentary filmmaking that captures their subjects directly, without voiceover narration, identifications, or interviews. Critics have said that their style captures real people and real events just as they happen. Their films are of great importance to historians. Foremost, the films themselves are phenomenal historical material. Through their films and through their decision to capture events as they take place while removing themselves from the film, scholars can really see visual sources of some of the most important developments of the post-1960s period. The films, for example, provide incredible insights into the evolution of the rock industry. Their films also provide wonderful documentation of American politics, which match anything that could be found at the National Archives or presidential libraries. Most impressive, of course, was The War Room in 1993, which now allows scholars and students to see how electoral campaigns were managed during this period, as if one was actually in the campaign. The film shows the changing relationship between party politics and the news media, the influence of scandal on the campaign process, and the seminal role of staff in the campaigns. Historians writing about politics in the 1990s will have incredible material to use in their research as a result of the film.
There's a simple doctrine. Outside of a person's love, the most sacred thing that they can give is their labor. And somehow or another along the way, we tend to forget that. And labor is a very precious thing that you have. And any time that you can combine labor with love, you've made a merger. And I think we're going to win tomorrow. And I think that the governor is going to fulfill his promise and change America. And I think many of you are going to go on and help him. I'm a political professional. That's what I do for a living. I'm proud of it. We changed the way campaigns are run.
My first question involves the most recent movie. How did you make the decision to shift from a movie on the heart of American politics in the early 90s to such a different subject on Broadway?
Well, we had really wanted to do a film about Broadway for a long time. At least I had. I had seen a film that Pennybaker was involved in called Jane, which was on Jane Fonda's Broadway debut in a failed play called The Fun Couple. And I just loved it. And it was one of the reasons for me to go into this type of filmmaking, because I had started out really as an artist. And I was very used to, and I was worked as a camera person, and I was very used to shooting things myself and making things myself. And, you know, it was one of the earlier cinema verite type of films that I saw. And for me, it had, you know, all the elements of a feature film, because you had a star and a great story where people were going through, you know, all these wonderful anxieties and kind of a built-in climax of, you know, does the show make it or not? And, you know, I always wanted to do that story again. And I later met Penny, and we became partners and started working together. And I was always kind of urging him to, like, do another type of story about Broadway.
With a show that would not die the same night it opened, right?
Did the movie kind of meet your expectations of what you thought it would be as you were making it? Or did it turn out to be a different story?
Oh, it was much different, of course. There was nothing like it, and it never is, you know, in the same way that The War Room started out trying to be a film about a man becoming president, and, you know, really we ended up in this strange war room place and made a whole film, you know, that was unique in that it was the type of access that the mainstream media didn't get. And, you know, we had these other great characters that were running his campaign, which was James Carville and George Stephanopoulos.
But we're really looking for characters. I mean, the problem is that these films are so costly to do and require such a long time to make, in a sense. You have to shoot them, and then you have to edit them, and then you have to, if you're going to release them theatrically, you have to blow them up and mix them. You have to go through a whole lot of stuff specifically in order to be able to run it in a theater. And when you make that decision, it really is the only way you can probably in the end sell it to television or cable or home video. None of those people are very interested in films that only appear as a TV one-off. They want to have the feeling that what they're buying, and you talk to a whole different set of people when you go to sell it to television. If you want to sell it to them as a TV program, believe me, you meet the same people that order the Cokes, you know, and the hamburgers for the shows. If you sell it as a movie, then a different part of their operation buys it, and they buy that in the same fashion that they buy a regular Hollywood production. They may not pay as much for it, but in a sense, it then becomes an entire thing, and nobody thinks of cutting it or changing it particularly. They take out the X words, but, you know, only Disney does that, really. So you, in order to get these things together and bring them off, you have to be prepared to go into a theater with them. So if you're just saying, well, I'm looking for interesting characters, my butcher is really a fascinating person, you're not going to get very far with theaters. They just, you know, my butcher doesn't make it on the marquee. So you have to kind of go for people who are not necessarily celebrities, but they're people who are the best in kind of whatever it is they do, whether it's their thinking or playing golf or, you know, acting or whatever it is, that people kind of look to them as being a kind of leader in the field. And that helps you sell it down the line. So everything conspires to sort of determine before you even begin what you can and can't do. in the beginning, when I first started out, nobody even knew who we were. So we can make a film about anybody we wanted. And we made a lot of those, and they're still waiting for distribution. You know, you stick them away someplace, but there's not a lot of people waiting to see them.
One of the things people always mention, audiences and, you know, friends and critics, that how your movies really change people's perception of a character or the subject so dramatically, ranging from Dylan to Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that yourselves as you're making the movie, that the person you thought you were filming is very different, not just the story, but the person themselves?
Well, they become real. I don't know if I have a very definite idea before I begin of what they should be.
I don't think we ever know them very well, which is kind of one of the interesting aspects about how we make our films, because we really jump into them fairly blindly. And, you know, Penny hates to do any research, so he knows nothing. I like to at least kind of know their names and kind of what they do a little bit, but we really walk in blind, and we had no idea who James Carville was when we started filming him. He just seemed like, you know, somebody's totally mad drunken uncle or something in the campaign, and we kind of expected that he wouldn't be around too long, you know, at first glance. So, you know, we don't really have any preconceived notions, unless it's somebody who we've known about before. I mean, in the case of Carol Burnett, she's, you know, existed in our minds as a television persona, and, you know, she always seemed incredibly funny, and, you know, we always kind of wondered what she would be like as a real person, and in a lot of ways expected when we made the film about her that any time we pointed the camera at her, it would be incredibly funny. And what we didn't realize was that, you know, we were going to be following a real person in their real life situation. And, you know, as a human, they were subject to all the anxieties that everybody else is in a situation. And for Carol, coming back to Broadway after 30 years was quite a tense thing. And people, you know, had a lot of expectations of what Carol would be like or what she might do within the show that kind of caused things to spiral in all sorts of directions. So Carol actually was very reserved during most of the film and kept kind of under control by the director so that you kind of wouldn't act out and be goofing around all the time. So that was very different than we expected.
Do you think in your career now, you've chronicled so much of post-1960s American history. You have, from, you know, the rock and roll industry to politics to the energy crisis. And I was wondering, do you see your movies independently, the substance, or do you think there's a story you've been telling about America, either intentionally or after the fact through these films? Is there a common thread to your films?
I mean, I always think of our films as being very sociological, you know, and they're kind of a time capsule in one in some way or another, you know, even just in a very irrelevant type of way. If you look at, you know, how people dress, how people act, what they talk about, you know, all of that comes out just in the aspect of watching our movies. But I think also because we are making movies, you know, we're trying to tell a story, and so we've compacted history in a certain way.
And it's interesting because unlike regular fiction films where people go to a lot of trouble to try to, you know, not have the wrong kind of automobile for the time it's supposed to be taking place in, that kind of thing, they're incredibly accurate because they were done when they were done. And I think they do kind of, I mean, it always surprises me when I go back and see parts of a film like The Energy War or Town Bloody Hall. It isn't so much the clothes, because I'm not aware of those too much anyway, but the sensibility of the moment. For instance, in 1 p.m., you forget how almost paralyzed the country was with fear, and you kind of at the time you could kind of understand why Nixon was in such a paralysis himself, because there was this overhanging thing that somebody's going to push a button and there'd be some sort of revolution, you know. And now you look back on it, you can't believe for a minute that anybody thought that. But at the time, a lot of people were really very nervous and conducted their lives in a very nervous way. And that's history too. But it isn't a history that gets passed down easily. I mean, unless you have somebody like de Tocqueville happening to, through, you know, remarking on it as he goes through Chicago or something. But in general, I know I'm always surprised because I forget. The thing changes so slowly that you got to hear, and it always seemed like it always was like it is now. But it wasn't at all. It was very vastly different. And since I grew up in Chicago, I mean, I try to remember back what I thought about living in Chicago as a 12-year-old, you know, and I can remember really strange things like everybody knew Louis Armstrong was the best jazz player in the world. We just all knew that. I had maybe two kids I knew who were black, but basically most of the kids I knew were white kids. And we lived kind of up in the upper north side of Chicago. You never could hear Louis Armstrong on the radio. They never played black people on the radio. You could never hear Louis Armstrong. Yeah, we couldn't go to a bar and listen to him. We never even saw him or came close to hearing him in person. The only way you could hear him was you had to buy these little race records that Bluebird brought out, and they carefully made yellow labels so that you'd wouldn't mix them up with normal Bluebirds in which there weren't any black people singing or playing, right? So you'd rush out, everybody, and they cost about a nickel. You'd get them used, and or a dime, whatever it was. And that was how you heard Louis Armstrong. Well, now you know, you can't hear him. I mean, it's everywhere. It's like there's so much music that you want to turn it off after a while. But in those days, it wasn't. There were no radios playing on the streets. You know, nothing. And none of my family, I couldn't even use the word jazz in my house. It was a dirty word. And that's how much New Orleans affected Chicago, which was a long way. I didn't even know what New Orleans was or where it was. I had no idea. I hardly knew what jazz really was, but I knew, we all knew, this is the best. This guy's the best, whoever he is and wherever he is. You forget after a while that that was this condition that you lived under. That was the only condition you knew. So you were kind of accepted it and went on about your business. But that's what I like about filming in this sort of disorderly way, is you pick up that history at the time it happens. And I think that I don't think it makes it more accurate necessarily, because you pick up only the where you're standing around, you know, you miss somebody else's real changing point or whatever. But I think what you do get is extremely accurate to what it does, and that accuracy I don't think anybody ever got before. I mean, when you read someone like Herodotus, you can see he was trying to break free of all that fantasy history that hung over everybody. You know, the gods made me do it, you know, Helen won got the golden apple, whatever it was. Everybody had a way of accounting for anything that happened to them. And suddenly somebody said, wait a minute, let's see what really happened. What did Xerxes actually say to the guy before he chopped his head off? And he maybe would make it up. It's hard to tell where he got his information, but it was like he wanted to put down what really took place for the first time. And I think that was interesting, that was really a kind of documentary procedure which hadn't really existed till then. Although I don't know about the Dead Sea Scrolls, that's why I asked you. I have no idea whether they were a documentary concept or not. I have the feeling always that they were religious surcharges that you just had to accept. And it gave somebody drew more power from his position by being able to make you read this thing, you know, like pretty much like the way literature is treated in schools. You know, whatever you read is what you know about. What you didn't read, you never know about. It doesn't exist.
How do you feel when your movies, though, quickly become part of the history? The War Room was around Washington as it came out in the years that followed. Yeah, yeah. And it's become synonymous with Clinton and his strategy, and it's often referred to in articles. Mm-hmm. How does that make you feel?
It's interesting. You know, when your film becomes you know, referred to in the context of, you know, everything that goes on with an administration and kind of gets looked back upon. But, you know, I think it's part of what they're about. And, you know, it's especially interesting in the war room because it's taken on so many different views as time goes on. I mean, the whole front of the film with Jennifer Flowers, of course, is watched in a totally different way now. And, you know, that happened all along. And, you know, it happens with every film because history is very subjective also. And I know even if you just watch a film like Don't Look Back, you know, you'll get, you know, a percentage of the audience that idolized Dylan and just, you know, love everything about the film. And then you'll get another group in the audience that hate Bob Dylan and feel like the film totally confirms that he's the jerk they always thought he was, and, you know, even more so. And, you know, I think that's a very interesting element of our films.
One of the things I was struck, well, I was watching them again, that in the documentary film, unlike a fiction film, the characters themselves keep changing after the movie's over.
Mm-hmm.
So I would imagine that an audience's response can change, not just at the time, but the same people 10 years later will see all these movies very differently. Have you found that?
A very funny thing happened like that, and I'm not sure what the end product was, but somebody just told us we sold Don't Look Back, about Bob Dylan, to the airlines, you know, so they play it on the little airline screens, and Bob Dylan was flying on some flight the other day, and Don't Look Back came on the airplane, and he called up his manager and, you know, said, did you know that this is going to be on there, and this and that. But, it, you know, that must be a very funny moment for somebody, you know, as you say, because they grow. They, you know, we've frozen them in time in a certain way, and they've gone somewhere else, and kind of to look back on this forever document.
These things are flies in amber, there's no question. And if you see them as such and kind of prize them in that totally messed up kind of look, then they become really, they become jewels. If you just say, well, you know, the film doesn't apply anymore. It's like the war room. If you saw it now, it might almost be embarrassing to see George extolling Clinton about how now we're the schools and stuff. I mean, I could see in a theater that would get a giggle. You know, maybe, but who knows, in 10 years it might bring tears to your eyes. So you just have to think, it's out of my hands. I got to fly into the goddamn piece of amber, and I closed up the gate, and now it's everybody else's problem. It's not my problem anymore. And I kind of feel like that. I don't have very much to do with them once they're done. So, I mean, you don't feel like correcting them, or, I mean, there are one or two places in these films where I keep hoping when the guy goes through the door, he won't hit his head, you know, and I keep looking as hard as I can each time, thinking, this time he won't hit his head, because he always does. But there's that aside from that aspect, I think you disconnect from them, because you were just a watcher to begin with. I mean, it wasn't something that came out of your brain as a piece of, some kind of inflatable thing that you conceived and put together and built before the eyes of everyone. It's, you were in a corner watching, and somebody let you in. So the whole film is really their film to begin with, and your role is some kind of, you're like a UN translator or something.
I always feel great feelings of nostalgia when I go back and watch certain films like this, because, you know, if it's
because we had such a good time at the time.
If it's a very successful film for me, it really can evoke a certain period in my life. And I know I felt that when I first saw Don't Look Back, which I saw, you know, some years after it was made. And it just, you know, brought back to me that exact period of my life. And, you know, I was Dylan fan, whatnot. And, you know, the same thing happens with a lot of films. You know, I'm sure for people who were involved in the Clinton campaign, you know, that moment is very strong, because that was a very passionate moment for all those people. And when we showed it to a lot of those people, which was a year later, they had all gotten jobs in the White House at that point. And, you know, a lot of them came up afterwards and thanked us for showing them the film because it reminded them of all the ideals they had when they first started to work for the Clinton campaign, you know, before they went into the White House and were bombarded by, you know, everything that you get when you start, you know, trying to legislate. And, you know, I think these films have a very strong sense of that. And that's something I think that film can do best, almost. I mean, I think writing can do it, but a film is even more so because you really see those images and every aspect of what life was like.
Well, it's true. I think it's like trying to write down a dream. You can write down the various exits and entrances and whatever that you recall. If you train yourself to do it and you get good at it, I mean, you can't just right off the bat, but I think people can get to do it. But what they can't get hold of is the mood. And a dream is so driven by mood that it's amazing, you know. And you could go through a whole process of doing something with people and you're sad. The thing you'll never write down is I was sad. You'll write down all the things you did. And the sadness, you may even have forgotten it by the time you wake up. But through the dream, there was this mood thing. And I think film, if it's done right, if it's perceived in a certain way, and if it's then edited not to lose that, can hold on to that mood. And I think that's one of the things that makes the documentary film so unique, because it wasn't put there by yourself. All you did was get to be very good at listening for it and getting it. But whereas in a normal fiction film, it's put there by somebody, and if it's Chekhov, it's fantastic. If it's you know, Meatloaf, it's not quite so hot. So the problem of talent is really what mostly determines the quality of fiction, whether it's theater or movie. Talent almost got nothing to do with documentary. And that's why it is a different art form. And I think it's just at the beginning. I think that in 20 or 50 years, there are going to be changes. You know, Heisenberg's kind of new harmonies will somehow flow in there. And people will be conceiving and making up what will be perceived as documentary material in some way that I don't presently see. But I think it'll have the same effect on people as psychiatry did 100 years ago, that they'll suddenly say it's a new... Because I honestly think the most incredible moment in this century for all of us is about to happen, which is, I think, very soon, some physicist is going to scratch his head and say, oh my God, now I see how it started. And he's going to explain it, and somebody said, you're right. It's not a big deal at all. This happened, and then this happened, and then you got all these stars flying around and all this matter. But now we understand where it came from and why. And they're going to say, well, now what? And now what is the brain? Because there was no reason to have a brain when all that matter got blown up. You didn't need brains. It didn't have to end up in brains. It didn't have to end up anyway. It could have just flown around and made no connection. And I think that aspect of introspection, of scientific introspection, is going to suddenly attack the process that whatever the brain is, and it's going to be like Copernicus. It's going to be a whole new world. It's going to just suddenly fly up in your face. And I think that's something that the documentary film is going to be party to, because it has a way of getting at that fiction doesn't. Anyway, this is my sense of it. I haven't talked to Heisenberg about this, but I have it on good authority. He felt this was a good idea.
Can I ask about the style? You said in one interview I read that about your films that it's like an x-ray that sees through the bone. And then in the same interview you said you also never assume, though, that you're invisible, because that would be candid camera type of filmmaking.
Right.
I was wondering if you could talk about that statement and a little bit how you do capture your subjects at such unprotected moments, how you achieve
it. Well, it's a heavy thing. It's like moving in these things that shoot particles at something, and they hit the particles and then everything flies apart. I mean, it isn't just bringing in a a camera at the picnic and getting your aunt when she's drunk, you know, doing something funny. You're just holding it up like a mirror, and people are putting their insides into it, and it's not a passing reflection. I mean, it's a heavy piece of artillery to point at somebody. So I think it does kind of x-ray them. I mean, in the end, I think that's what was hard on Dylan when he first saw the film. He looked at me and he said, "Oh my God, how could they have gotten me like this? Here I am, the best protected mortal on the earth, and look, they got me sprawled out here. You know, it's not fair. This is not right. How did this happen?" And I think that that's a kind of aspect of it that always happens. People look at these films afterwards and they go into kind of shock because they hadn't realized they would be so exposed. But we're trying to make it so that all throughout the process, it's a joint process, even though they may not understand what that means till they see the film. I mean, they may think we're doing this nice thing together, you know, and when they see the film, they realize it's them that's on the screen, not us. They're the ones whose bones are showing. And I think that that's probably a hard thing for a lot of people to accept, even though it doesn't may show. For us, we look at it and we say, yeah, that's Carol Burnett. She may see it as showing every flaw in her body, and it may be really hard for her to bear. And she's the person who would do it with good grace. Some people would not. They'd scream and yell and sue you if you went ahead and released it. So you're always taking a chance that when you unload the thing, it'll be somebody's nightmare and not the wonderful film you thought you'd made. But I think that we try not to take keyhole pictures of anybody, because I think that would really violate our sense of what was fair. Our feeling there's no rules, but whatever you've managed to get on film, that's yours to do with as you decide to do, which is just, in other words, that's up to your editing and way of using it in making a full picture. If you don't get it, you can't ask them to do it again. You can't substitute something else. You can't fake it. If it didn't happen, you really have no right to make use of it. And you have no right to take advantage of people who are literally think they're in camera, that they're private, to use that where they're not expecting it in some way. So even though they may not have thought about you in the room and they don't notice the camera, or you don't think they do, I think most people are pretty much aware we're there all the time. I don't think we ever fool anybody that way. But if you started putting cameras in suitcases and behind doors, then I think you have another kind of film that I'm not sure would work at all. But it's a different kind of film. I think you can only use it for laughs, which is what Font did, pretty much.
Do you ever discover something as you're doing the film about the people involved that's relevant to the movie, but that they don't want shown, and that you can't, and you just don't get it on camera, and it's left out of the movie? Has that happened to you?
Yeah, sometimes.
That something's going on in the story that's, I wouldn't know what it is, but that was relevant to what is ultimately going to be released, but it's behind the scenes and they're not letting you capture it, or...
Oh, that we miss things.
Yeah.
Or that you're not allowed to say no.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, all the time, because it's really their film as much as ours. I mean, mostly that happens in the beginning because, you know, you're like the new person at a party or something, and... You know, they don't really know you or trust you, and, you know, you don't blame them. You feel the same way if somebody else is kind of new in your whole group, too. And you have to gain their trust in a lot of ways. I know when we first did The War Room, it happened continually that every time James and George went ahead for private conversation, they would walk out of the room. And then eventually it just got too hard for them to continually taking off their radio mics. And so we'd say, okay, well, we won't have them on. And they'd go out of the room. And then finally they just decided not to go out of the room anymore. But, you know, it's a process making
these
movies.
But I think he's thinking in terms of really important story elements.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason or other, we just missed. I know there are a couple, and I can't right now think of one, but where you didn't have an... It's like if we hadn't been able to shoot the Brazil tape,
mm-hmm.
and we had just, it wasn't good enough. We thought, looked at it, we tried, we could have maybe explained it, but we said, no, skip it, let's leave it out. And we do leave things out, because if they don't play right, well, one of the things we thought maybe would happen to us was the whole Mary Magdalene thing. But, you know, it's really interesting. These things are such a matter of luck. And out of nowhere, suddenly something happens, and we just managed to film it, and it explains all you need to know in order to understand whatever the Mary Magdalene connection was. If we hadn't gotten that, if we hadn't gotten him doing the interview, we probably couldn't have used her very well. We would not have any idea who she was.
Well, I mean, our films really, you know, start off being different than we think in a lot of ways. And, I mean, I know at the end of The War Room, we felt, because we were continually trying to make a film about a man who becomes president and be with Clinton much more than we were allowed.
No,
because, well, if they lost, we would have had a very nice, unsaleable film about a losing campaign team that no one probably would care if they saw again. So, you know, we kept pushing on that. And we thought, well, after he gave his speech and he had won, that we would get to be with our characters with Clinton in the back room. And, you know, in the end, we didn't have the Secret Service clearance little pin that about 10 people had in order to get back in that room. And I was very crushed at the time because I felt like, oh, God, we didn't get the end of the movie. We didn't get our characters, you know, embracing the president and this and that. And we had also filming with us our partner Nick Dube, and he had filmed the scene that's in the film of George Stephanopoulos kind of on the cellular phone to Clinton, you know, saying it's the best thing he ever did. And just, it was a very personal moment. In some ways, it was probably better because it was so personal and, you know, so right on the spot while he was walking to the, you know, to the speech and, you know, wonderful in that way. So in a lot of ways, we have to make our movies from what we get. We can't be everywhere in everything that's happening. And you have to know that. And you're going to miss about 90% of what goes on, especially if you shoot in film, because film is such a cumbersome medium. I mean, only a role only lasts for 10 minutes for us. And, you know, five of those are usually spent filming something totally worthless before we realize that and shut it off. And then finally, when something does happen, you know, we only get 5 minutes and then, you know, we're in this juggle of changing. So it's the nature of our beast, so to speak.
But, you know, we have this kind of sense that unlike the thing that makes the documentary basically non-dramatic, that makes it not drama, is when somebody tries to explain what you're watching, that it's like, it's somehow the reaction is that you want to put the whole thing away. And that, like theater, you know, you never have to explain theater. And in fact, the less you explain, the stronger it is. So you're going toward a kind of polarization of whatever is dramatic in your material toward less and possibly no explanation. And once I got I thought the idea that how far could you go? And I met this woman who was married to a producer at the film board, and they had been driving up to Montreal, and they had a car accident. They ran into a horse, and the guy was killed. And she didn't. She survived and wasn't actually not badly hurt at all. But what happened was she then discovered several weeks later that she was pregnant. She hadn't known she was going to be pregnant. So suddenly she's going to have a child. She's totally desolate. The shock was terrible, and they were very young and totally in love. But she got this huge settlement from an insurance company, which was like, it was like she was getting paid off. In other words, it was making up for his having, so she was riddled with guilt and depression and really suicidal. And I thought, you know, could you make a film with her just doing some normal thing? And so there was a friend of mine there, was a filmmaker that I knew, and he had a girlfriend that came down from Montreal. So the two of them came down, and we just drove around one afternoon just talking, and I made a little film called Michelle et Michelle, because the other girl was named Michelle too. And I thought, could you just put this on a screen and not explain any of this to people? And would they get, would some of it slip through, or would you, in some mysterious way, would it ooze out of the film, and people would say, God, she's been through some kind of shock? Because at one point in the film, we decided to go riding. I mean, I didn't go riding, because I wouldn't get on a horse with a camera anyway, but they got, two or three of them got on horses. No, she said, do you want to get on it? She said, no. And I said, what's the matter? And she said, don't you know how I feel about horses? And that was the only thing that ever happened. It was kind of like the end of the pound thing, where he said, when a man wakes up with a hoarfrost on his tent, he knows how cold the night was. There's no in the entire thing of that long poem, there's never any, he never gets pissed at anybody, you know. He just, as if he weren't put in a cage on the side of a hill. And it didn't work at all. But I always thought, if you were good enough and figured out how to do it, you probably could make that something like that work by not telling anybody anything and making. But people don't want to do that kind of work anyway. And besides which, now all movies, you know, they help you so much that you hardly do any guessing, except on the level of the 12 Monkeys or something like that, where it's a whodunit kind of concept, which is interesting and fun, but it's not what I mean. I mean trying to guess psychologically what this character's about. It interests me totally, and I'm always trying to see if we can do it. But in the end, it's really more important you don't lose people, I think. So you're caught up in just the storytelling problems. And all of the, and the experimental aspects are very hard to hang on to.
When you start a movie, do you actually sit down and have specific, kind of agree on specific guidelines with the people, mm-hmm. of what you can do and what you can't? Or is that just, do they agree to let you in and they'll do that on their own?
Well, you know, each film is different. Usually you have some kind of arrangement with them that you're going to show them the film afterwards, and you know, if there's anything that's inaccurate, you will change it, because you don't want to make something that you've got the story wrong somehow. But we don't ever ask them to edit the film or kind of really be part of that, but we like to kind of share it with them and make sure of that. But no, we try not to. As a matter of fact, we never even really sign anything with people beforehand.
We don't plan too much, actually. We just sort of, Chris decides, I mean, we decide where to start and when, and that's usually just, we don't have many options, you know. Once we get the money, we're ready to start. It's as simple as that. And then we kind of take it and ride along with it as it goes. We don't really say, well, we should, we should be following this motivation or that. We don't think that smartly. We're kind of dumb, actually. I think that's what probably makes the things work, is that we go at it in a very dumb way. And so we kind of end up getting everything, because people keep saying that, Jesus, they weren't even filming when I said such and such, I'll have to say it again. And they do, you know, they kind of make sure we get it, because we don't seem to know, and I don't. I'm probably as politically dumb about what was happening on the war room as anybody alive. And so they help me out, you know, and a little bit.
Does that ever happen too much, that you get the sense these people are helping you out too much on the film, where they're acting? It's moving a little beyond the documentary, or no? Is that
usually not? I mean, if somebody, you know, is the type of personality that really acts towards the camera, you know, which is kind of what James's personality, which is why the war room was just the perfect environment that he made for himself, because he loves to kind of be on stage and, you know, have everybody to kind of bounce ideas against, and he kind of created an office that had a whole room full of people to do that with, and, you know, I think we were just another one in the room, but you know, that's just his personality. But you know, everybody knows the camera's there. I think you'd you know, be fooling everyone if you said that they didn't know we were there. But usually we try to film people who are doing things in their lives that are so important to them that they just get involved in that and kind of forget that we're there.
And you're looking to have dialogue-driven character, as in plays, you know, as in theater. And if people can come up with dialogue that does that, no matter what their intentions were, you know, that serves the purpose both in their, whatever their situation is, but it also serves our purpose. So we're always looking for that, listening for that. Because we would like to have the whole film start and never stop for an instant, just move as fast as it can and be all dialogue, all character-driven dialogue, as it were. And that, you know, is the ideal kind of scene. And you would like to have scenes that are real time, that never have to edit, you never have to have a cutaway, you never have to stop the real time flow, because the minute you do, then people begin to suspect that you want them to think a certain way or see it a certain way. But when it's real time, they don't have time to think that. They think the wheel went around and it never stopped, so that must be the real wheel going around, you know, and they see it that way. Then it has a real ring of reality, which is kind of what you want to do. You want to get that reality sense so strong in the film that people never doubt it for a minute.
One of the things that in your movies I think you've captured well is part of the business of entertainment, the entertainment industry. And as far back as Don't Look Back, you have that great scene with Grossman to get the best fee for right. Dylan through what you're doing right now with the Broadway. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on this, if you turn the lens to yourselves and would do something on documentary filmmaking right now, the business
what
side of it.
What would we see?
What would you see? Or what will we see?
Nothing that would want make you go into the business, I'll tell you. It's a very hard, it's a very hard hill to climb, because I don't think people see. They don't see. I mean, if you talk to somebody who's made a mediocre film that hadn't done very well, they're still full of beans because they think the next one is really going to go out of the park and I'm going to make a million. You know, I don't think anybody thinks that about documentary films. It doesn't seem that it can do that in that kind of world, in the theatrical world. And of course, we never expected to do that. But I think people who put money up and who own theaters and distribution companies, that's really what they're in it for. And very few of them just want to see the game stretched or try something new just for fun to see what happens. They get over that very fast. And they just want to make get whatever it is, they want it to be the next big moneymaker, you know. And that kind of was what drives the business now. So if you're making documentaries, it's almost like you're in a different business, although people think, because it's their films, well, films are films, you know, you sit in a seat and watch them, and they happen in theaters, and it must be, but it's as different as you know, religious lectures or things on Scientology or something, to what the real business is about, which is where it's kind of celebrity driven, really. It's seeing people that you know very well through all of the promotion and advertising that goes on about them do some story that you already know, and it's not going to be too different from the last time it was done. And nobody wants any real change, and they certainly don't want the idea of the art form where you're avant-garde. I mean, I don't think it invites the avant-garde. And of course, people doing their own films get very bored with things that aren't sort of avant-garde. So they're going different directions. And it's hard for an audience to keep up with them. So everybody uses the term niche audience, whatever that means, but it's probably very real. And it means that you're not going into this with the same hopes that that they had when they made Pulp Fiction, you know, and that was an independent, off-the-wall film. But when they made it, everybody knew it might, you know, go through the ceiling. And these films, I don't think anybody has that idea. I mean, Sometimes they do. It's like a lottery, though. I mean, you're not. If you were counting on that, you might as well play the lottery. You'd probably have a better chance of winning.
Are there certain types of documentaries, though, of the few that make it, that the audiences react to and the, I guess, producers react to?
I think it has to do with advertising and promotion to a large degree. I don't know.
I mean, in this country, it definitely has to do, with promotion and some kind of celebrity or sensationalism that they can hang something on. And then, some kind of backing behind it. I mean, if for some reason, if you get enough dollars behind something and throw it at it, you can make it, have enough hype that people pay attention. And, and then, of course, you have to figure in some reviews in there to make it last. But, even that, if you have enough money, you can get beyond those, too. And, that was one of the things I think, that Moon Over Broadway shows is the, the power of advertising something.
Of the spin.
And, spinning it and just, making a life for something. And I think that's important because, a lot of times critical response can just kill something that, could have had more of a life than it ended up having. And, if somebody, believes in something and can put it out there so that the public can, make their own opinion on it, I think that's good.
Are there any young documentary filmmakers right now that you would point to as leaders in the next generation? Or?
Well, there's a lot of good filmmakers around. I mean, they, we know, they're not necessarily so young, but they're, they do. I mean, you have the thing kind of dividing up in certain ways that I guess I never anticipated. You have people making films like Nick Broomfield, who becomes a character in the film, and he appears on camera, and after a while he becomes a character and you begin to know his character, and that's kind of, and he's funny and slightly mean. And that becomes part of what you see in the film, is his role on the people he's talking to or dealing with. And that becomes a very real part of the film. So he becomes an actor in his own film. And a number of people have done that. Michael Moore,
Ross McCallum.
Ross has done that. And that's a sort of an interesting way. And that's come out of the old diary films that were around maybe 20 years ago or 15 years ago, and were really, at the time, I thought they were kind of wonderful because they were so, everybody doing them did such totally different take on what a diary was, or what their life was like. So you got all these kind of marvelous historical moments in somebody's time or in somebody's life. And those films were tended to be very long, almost unwatchable for a general audience. So they didn't turn into anything very much, except as people who got to know them and like them really treasured them, but they never went out into the real world in any kind of abundance. And I think that this is sort of the outgrowth of that. And then there are other people who've kind of gotten discouraged, who've made some really good films, and they've kind of hunkered down, and they're either they teach, that's one way that people survive, and they teach, or they just do other things, they sell equipment or whatnot. So I don't think all of the young filmmakers that I think are really whose films interest me can necessarily make it in film. That's the kind of sad thing, but some do, and some really surprise you in their ability to survive and be ready to do something when the time comes. And that's kind of what part of it's about. I don't know, I teach a little bit. I see people who want to make films and they kind of don't understand what the next step is. They want to do it, but they're not sure. They haven't quite made the connection with what they, what they get their hands on and what they do with it when they do. And I think the problem they have largely is they're not aware of all of what's been done. So they have to they feel this need to keep doing it again, to reinventing it. And that's just a problem of the way the system works. How do you see films? If you're not near a film library or a place that has a lot of these things in some sort of video format, where do you find out what Maya Duran did 50 years ago? Hard. Very hard.
Are you working on a new project now?
Are we working on new projects? Tell me.
We're kind of in our proposal writing stage where we have a variety of projects of all kind of sorts of subject matter that we're trying to raise money on. And I'm not sure which one of them will happen. We'll just see. Sometimes we kind of go at these things without any money, but we've recently found that to be very painful. So we're trying to find something that we can actually fund beforehand.
Yeah, we always have two or three different things that we could get into. Unfortunately, in the beginning, when I first started out, we always had this idea that we would always be ready to do a film that we could shoot in one day with four or five rolls of film. Because film was very cheap, black and white film. We used to get it from DuPont in those days. And it was not such an expensive thing to do, and you could make a little short film, and it was, I mean, they were kind of very effective, and I still look at them. I show them whenever I get a chance, because there they are. They're unique little slices of some moment, you know, like Timothy Leary getting married or whatever. You know, these are strange moments in our history. But that's hard to do for us now. And it's too bad. And I had thought maybe when video came along, we'd get ourselves a video camera and just run around making video films of each other. But, you know, you don't do that. It's hard, very hard to make films of your own family, I find. And I don't know if every filmmaker feels this, but it's like your film is such a serious business that you're sort of hesitant about using it in terms of a family relationship or a family thing. But it's wrong. I mean, you should make films about everything around you, and I really admire filmmakers that do that.
I'm very proud to have done this. I'm as happy as I can be, and I'm so proud. We won Nevada big, Governor. It's looking like close to 400. It's a landslide. Ohio's not called yet, North Carolina's not called yet. But everything else, I mean, Michigan, dead even in Florida, and you know, it's just unbelievable. You ought to be the happiest man in the world. And I just gotta tell you, I mean, I just appreciate this so much. This was the best thing I ever did.
Now that's the platform we're running on. We promise to swing it from now on. Fellow citizens, all right, follow me. And vote for Mr. Rhythm Jamboree.
You have been listening to another edition of Talking History, an interview with filmmakers D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus. Julian Zelizer, Assistant Professor of History and Public Policy at the University at Albany, conducted this interview on September 25, 1998. Our thanks to the New York State Writers Institute for their help in arranging this interview. Audio excerpts from the Pennebaker and Hegedus film, The War Room. This segment was produced at the Talking History Studio in the Department of History, University at Albany. Producer and editor, Professor Gerald Zahavi. Co-producer, Susan McCormick. Talking History is a co-production of the History Department, University at Albany, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska.